Thank you very much indeed. I'm not quite sure how long I'm going to be this afternoon, because the subject could be half a day or it could be 5 minutes. 5 minutes, because talking about intimacy with God in public is about as easy or as difficult as talking about other kinds of intimacy in public. Half a day or more, or half a lifetime, because you never quite run out of things to say. But what I'd really want to do in the time available this afternoon is to try and think with you a little bit about why it is and how it is that people wanting to talk about God have turned to the language of human intimacy and human love, and what they think they've been doing, and what effect that has both ways, both on what we say about human love and what we say about God. It seems to me that people begin this process when they ask the question, what kind of change does God bring to human lives? And you cast around to try and find something that feels a little bit like that level of change. You cast around in the whole range of human experience and say, well, what is it that makes that sort of difference, that much difference? And it doesn't take long for people to come to the conclusion that one of the experiences that most obviously makes that level of difference is the experience of being humanly in love. It goes back a long way, because it's in the first century of the Christian era, it's in Jesus' lifetime probably, that people are having debates about whether you put the Song of Songs into Holy Scripture. Because the Song of Songs is a very highly charged erotic poem. It's full of the kind of thing which even the most liberated cleric on a Sunday morning reading from the Song of Songs might just want to blush and cough over a little bit. It's about passion and yearning, about a hunger for another person. A hunger that's expressed with a real nakedness, real rawness, that still makes it extraordinarily powerful reading. And it got into the Bible because people were able to say, Jews first and then Christians. Well, it's about the sort of experience that is at least a bit like being intimate with God. It's about the kind of experience that makes that kind of difference. And people commenting on this, Jews and Christians throughout the centuries, were very conscious of the fact that all this was quite ambiguous stuff, you know, quite explosive stuff. That eros, erotic passion, yearning, longing for another person, wasn't exactly a tame tiger, as they say. And once let out, it was rather difficult to get back in. All the same, they took the risk. They decided that it was all right to accept that part of the Bible could be read as a song, a poem, about human selves in love with God, even though the words used were shot through with the most intense, the most heavily charged language about human loving. And so it is that quite often in the history of Christian thinking, Christian writing, and Christian praying, you get works of art like the Song of Songs in the Old Testament, where it's, on the face of it, actually impossible to tell whether it's human love or divine love that's being talked about. Pick up one of the poems of St. John of the Cross from the 16th century, and you can read the whole of the, what is it, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, the whole of the 8 stanzas of this particular poem, the Song of the Soul, without actually having a clue that it's about God. On a dark night, all my anxieties inflamed by love. What a brave adventure this was. With nobody in sight, I slunk out of the house with everybody else asleep. Safely in disguise, up the secret stairs I crept. What a brave adventure this was. No other eyes to see me, and everyone else in the house asleep. And on that lucky night, in secret, with nobody to see me, off I went, nobody watching, no other light except the light in my heart. And that was the one that led me through, more clearly than the light of noonday, to where somebody was waiting for me, somebody I knew very well, where I expected no one else to be. It's strong stuff, and as I say, if you didn't have a few helpful, pious capital letters there, you wouldn't be able to tell whether it was about somebody simply slipping out in the middle of the night for an assignation, or about God. So what's going on here? Why is it that we reach for this sort of language? Well, I don't profess to be any kind of an expert on the processes of falling in love. God help anybody who does profess to be an expert on that. But there are things which I guess most of us will know, most of us will recognize in that process of human falling in love. And I want you just to think a bit about what those processes are and those moments are, and see whether they don't open some possibilities for thinking about what it's like to draw close to God and to have God's difference made to you. When you fall in love with somebody, the world organizes itself around that person. Sometimes you think you see them all over the place, even in very unlikely places. And when you don't see them, of course, their absence is a great screaming void. The world organizes itself around somebody. All roads lead towards a person. And as you all know, you can tell when you're talking to somebody in casual conversation whether they've really got a passion for somebody by the number of times that a name is introduced casually into conversation. Conversations lead that way. There's something magnetic about this. And in the very early stages, you're often more interested in the fact that they are the person they are, rather than in what response they might have to you. Quite a lot of romantic literature turns on the fact that sometimes people who fall deeply in love never quite have the nerve to tell the people they're in love with that they're in love with them, because somehow they're satisfied that the people are just who they are. They don't want to take it any further. They're indifferent to the response, even embarrassed by it. And then there's, of course, the great astonishment if they do actually respond. Am I, in fact, worth looking at? Am I worth taking seriously in that way? My God, it seems I am. I never expected that. Not from them. And sometimes with that, there goes a longing that other people fall into the same pattern. I'd like to see everybody else being as happy as I am. I'd like to see everybody else experiencing this kind of difference. Which is why sometimes people who are deeply in love are a great nuisance to their friends, because they set up matchmaking or interfering in their lives or trying to make them happy, which is a terrible thing to do to your friends, as you know. But it's all part of that big difference that is being made. A difference which so far comes over as pretty positive. The world looks different. The world is organized. Makes some sort of sense, goes in some sort of direction. I've got something to be really glad of, that somebody else is the person they are. Never mind what they do or say to me. But equally, astonishingly, perhaps they do say yes to me, perhaps they do respond, and that's fantastic. And it overflows. And then, of course, there's the downside of it. Because if all this is true of the glories, the positive side of intimacy, what about when things are not going smoothly? I've already said the absence of a loved one is another way of organizing space. Things remind you of them, and they're not there. Things nudge at your memory, pull at your nerve ends, and the person isn't there. Or the person is there, and you haven't got a clue how they're going to respond, and suddenly this matters. It didn't at first, but now it does. What's going on in them? What are they thinking of? What are they after? I've no idea. Why don't they talk to me? Why can't I break through? And somehow that can fuel a doubt in myself as deep and as serious as the love or the joy that was there before. And I can end up in a total emotional confusion towards the object of my love. I'm not quite sure whether I love them or hate them. Probably both, quite a bit of the time. Some of you may remember the great brief poem of Catullus, great Latin love poet. I hate and I'm in love. I've no idea how this can be. I just know that that's how it is, and I'm in torment with it. So the downside, the absences. And again, if I were to turn to John of the Cross, I could point to other poems of his where essentially the pattern, the story is that everything reminds you of an absence. Something's happened, something's changed, but what now? And where is the great power, the presence that made that change? Who knows? Where are you hiding? Where are you hiding? You've left me here in tears, and off you go like a hunted stag into the woods, and you leave me bleeding. And I followed, calling at the top of my voice. And did you care? Maybe the soul talking to God, but there have been moments, I guess, when quite a lot of us have said that to others. You've made a difference. You've come in and made things look different and feel different. And now where the hell have you gone? Are you just leaving me here? I was happy before. Before all the difference was made, before all the changes started. So now what? And then, of course, if our lives evolve in this way, then the enormous highs and the desperate lows of experience that we begin with sort of settle. Maybe we do bond for good and all with somebody who loves us and whom we love. Maybe there is a settling down. Maybe we learn a kind of confidence in respect of the people around us, and a confidence in respect of the person we love that doesn't need to be reassured all the time, so that when nothing's going on, maybe we can cope with that. It's just life unfolding. We're confident that we're looked at, we're seen and accepted, and we don't have to be told that all day and every day. And we're confident too, I think, in a love relationship that's maturing. We're confident of something very odd, rather paradoxical. Confident that we haven't yet come to the end of the person we love. There's more to explore, and they haven't come to the end of us. How many couples, I wonder, have had that moment of panic early on when they say, what are we going to be talking about in 10 years' time? Won't we just sit and stare at each other in silence, paralyzed? And mysteriously, for really quite a lot of human beings, it doesn't happen like that. You don't come to the end of another person. There's more to uncover. There's more to experience. And day by day, you discover there's more of you, as well as more of them. All of that is, dare I say, the routine experience of quite a lot of human beings. And I don't mean to use routine in any insulting sense here. It's actually the bread of our lives. One way or another, these moments, these aspects of falling in love are just there for us. We know what it's like to find the world reorganized. We know what it's like to find the world apparently empty and disoriented because someone isn't there. Many of us are graced with knowing what it's like to be in the kind of steady relation where we don't have to be reassured. Many of us discover that there's more of us than we ever expected because somebody is looking at us with love and not looking away too soon. And somehow it's all of that which causes people to reach eagerly and sometimes recklessly for the language of human love when they want to talk about God. Because behind all this is the recognition, and it's quite a difficult recognition in some ways, that discovering God, knowing God, relating to God is not something which happens instantly, once and for all, giving you all the answers, mapping your life, and that's it. The sense of discovering yourself, learning to live with yourself in new ways, the sense of the world being reorganized around you, all of that which does not happen overnight, all of that is part of our discovery of God, of intimacy with God. And it seems we need a story to help us with that. That God, the recognition that God is not something instantly mastered or possessed or contained or reduced. And this is where, of course, the two kinds of discourse impact on each other. The more we experience human love in this way, the sense of things not being exhausted, not coming to the end of people, the more we take seriously what happens to us in that process, the more we begin to understand that it would be very bizarre if our relationship to God was somehow less than that, less interesting, less developing, less of a story. It is, I think, one of the most extraordinary things we ever do, but we do it, to talk and behave as if our relationship with God was somehow less varied, less changing than our relationship with other human beings. But as I say, we do it. We make our relationship to God one-dimensional, while knowing perfectly well in our human experience that's not what we're like. But equally, we can move towards God, discovering something of the endlessness of God's patient regard and the endlessness of God's resources, and turn from that and discover more about our own human relationships than we ever suspected. There's more to us than meets the eye. Our experience of human love and divine love tells us that, and tells it to us very, very firmly. So our experience of human love, if we think about it, we let ourselves experience it fully, if we use the resources of our imagination and our intellect on it, should open up for us an extraordinary excitement about what it might be like to relate to God. And the contemplation of God in intimacy, in that silent, longing discovering that St. John of the Cross talks about, that brings us back to our world, the world of human relations, with new expectations, reinforcing for us what people are, how people live, reinforcing that sense of disturbing, inviting mysteriousness that there is in every human presence, behind every human face. And I was going to say I'm going to digress, but I'm not exactly going to digress, but it's a kind of remark in brackets. This is where the experience that people rather misleadingly call mysticism actually has a colossal impact on what we think about ethics and politics. Mysticism is not something belonging to a set of idol specialists, people who are getting on with this mysterious private activity called religiousness. It's about the expansion, the alteration of human perception in such a way that we see every human being differently. And I can't stress too strongly the importance of this. If you don't have people who are taking God with immense, intimate seriousness around, then sooner or later, what you think and feel about human beings is going to shrink, and shrink badly. In other words, if it should happen that our world ended up completely secularized, to use that rather unhelpful technical term, if we got into a world where everybody was assessed and understood in terms of their function, in terms of their job, in terms of their surfaces, then it wouldn't just be God that would have been lost. It would be us. It would be us. And one of the things that this tradition of mystical reflection, mystical prayer and poetry ought to make us aware of is that at the end of the day, if you lose intimacy with God, you lose something about humanity. And you lose the something about humanity that makes us lovers and strugglers for justice and artists and all the rest of it. So the strange implication of this seems to be that understanding what's going on in the writings of some of the great lovers of God, especially when they use the language of human love for the love of God, understanding what's going on there is bound up with the whole business of understanding how we as human beings are going to live intelligently with ourselves. Take the one away, and there is less of the other left. Less capacity to live intelligently, lovingly, imaginatively with yourself. This, I suppose, is one of the things which, at the end of the day, is most deeply distinctive about Christian language. And that's not to make a sort of Christian chauvinist remark, just to try and observe that for Christians, there's a very special sense in which the depth and inexhaustibility of God and the depth and inexhaustibility of human beings is caught up together. When Christians talk to Buddhists about contemplation and meditation, they have a lot to say to each other, and a lot that's constructive, deeply creative. They also, I think, have some questions to put to each other. And the Buddhist experience of realization of a reality which is both self and not self, which is not a God, but just a supreme presence, a there-ness. That is, I think, for any Christian, a sobering, deepening encounter to reflect on. But the Christian will want to go on and say, and yet there is something about the mutuality of persons, the inexhaustibility on both sides, that means we can't quite finally just settle down with that model of what it's like to grow into full humanity. And so the debate unfolds. The Buddhist may very well say, yes, but what do you mean by person? And the Christian may very well say, yes, but what do you mean by enlightenment? And so it goes on, and a very useful conversation it is. But I would want to say that there is that distinctiveness in the Christian perspective there, which has to do precisely with all of this business about the relevance of our human love experience to our experience with God. How is it that the world is reorganized? Concretely, specifically, in lives like yours and mine, how does the world get to change? And how do I get to change? Through that experience we call falling in love. And so whatever it is that the life and death and resurrection of Jesus is about, it must have something to do with the experience of falling in love. Two more observations about what the love of God does to our human love. We can't train ourselves to talk. If you were, as apparently some idiot in the 17th century did, if you were to leave a child on its own for the first 2 or 3 years of its life to discover what language it would naturally speak, you ought not to be surprised when it hasn't got anything to say at the end of that period. We talk because we are talked to, and we can't talk ourselves into talking. Love is like that. With our own resources, we can't love ourselves into life. And one of the most appalling and tragic things about our humanity is the number of people around who live their lives with a kind of long-term deficit of love. That is, those for whom early and formative years were so isolated or so abusive or so deeply unhappy that they're never quite drawn into life thereafter. Left to ourselves, we haven't got resources. And so, to be loved is to be inducted into our humanity, just as surely as being talked to is. We can't do it for ourselves. And it means that when we turn to thinking about God, we may realize how little we have as human beings of a resource that is just ours, and how much we need to be talked to be loved into life, or indeed, picking up the image of this weekend, to be kissed into life. Which is one reason, I suppose, why I'm not ever very happy with those versions of religious language which say, at the end of the day, we're talking about ourselves, about our choices, our values, and our hopes. I don't believe that, because I don't believe that's how human beings actually grow and how differences are made to human beings. I don't believe that when I speak of God, I'm speaking in a roundabout way of myself and the nicest and best and most helpful things I can think of. Because I'm uncomfortably aware that the nicest and best and most helpful things I can think of for myself are precisely what I think are the nicest and best and most helpful things. And experience suggests, inexorably, that I am not always right about what the nicest and best and most helpful things are for myself, let alone anybody else. I need to be surprised. I need to be taken unawares. I need to be jolted into something different if the world is to be reorganized and I am to grow beyond what I already am. And so to think of the relation between human intimacy and intimacy between humans and God is to think about the way in which love is always surprising, always takes us unawares. And dating agencies or no dating agencies, there are very few people who form their most lasting relationships simply by ticking a series of boxes. That creates, if you like, a version of our own fantasy. But it doesn't change things. Back to the question, the issue I began with. What sort of difference does God make? A difference like the difference made by falling in love. A difference that surprises. And that's why I suppose any kind of seriously surprising human love is a theological experience. Don't go around telling people that because it'll put them off. But within these four walls, I think we can reasonably say that genuinely surprising love is about theology. And the second big thing that comes out of this bringing together of human love and divine love is, I think, something to do with the discovery of what the dimensions of faithfulness can be. It's possible, it seems, given the story we tell about God, it's possible for love to be uneven, for love to be bruised and injured, for love to be deeply unequal on each side, and yet, again and again, to salvage itself in faithfulness. It's the story that the Hebrew scriptures tell. It's the story that the Christian scriptures tell. This is not a marriage made in heaven, the story told in the Bible. But it is the story of how faithfulness reappears, remakes itself, revindicates itself over and over again. And if we turn from there to our human relationships, then we may very well have a good deal to ponder. Hurt and failure, inequalities, dead ends, brick walls, we mustn't take for granted that any of them are final. There may be a story to be told on the far side. and we don't know it yet. I don't say that in any way which is meant to suggest that happy answers and easy answers are always blandly available. They're not, of course they're not. But anyone going into a long-term committed relationship of human love needs a ground for hope, needs a story to be told of how faithfulness can rescue itself from failure. And that is the story we tell as Christians about relationship with God. A story which suggests that how my interests are met, how my needs are satisfied, is seldom likely to be the most important or the most interesting thing in the evolution of a relationship. A story to be told. I suppose that's what I come back to again and again, thinking about this issue. Our human lives of intimate love are stories. They're nothing if not stories. I began by outlining some of the more frequent and recognizable features of those stories. The initial stages, the fear and awe of the person we love, and then the obsessional worry about absence or failure of response. A story. A story which we know is still important to us because people still write rather a lot of novels and produce rather a lot of films about it. A story which still encourages people to imagine and to go deeper. As I say, it's very odd if that's how our lives are, if we can't see that that is also something that applies to our intimacy with God. Yes, we have a biblical story, or rather a lot of biblical stories. A story which is indeed about a love affair between God and God's creation. But it takes a very particular kind of breakthrough. The breakthrough that I suppose those rabbis in the first Christian century were making with the Song of Songs. A very particular kind of breakthrough to say, that story is also my story, potentially. The difference that God makes to God's people in the Old Testament, the difference Jesus makes to God's people in the New Testament, that kind of difference can be happening in my life, my personal life too. And in discovering God, I don't discover a formula. I don't discover a single lasting, satisfying image. I don't discover a sort of plateau where I can settle down. I embark on a story. You can get this wrong, obviously. You can turn the story into a system. You can draw diagrams. St. John of the Cross, bless him, spent a lot of his energies writing about the experiences he'd described in his poems. Most people, I have to say, find the poems easier. But don't be put off by that. The real problem is when other people came along and read not only the poems, but the prose very intensively, and turned it into a system, and presented people with a kind of diagram of how you were doing. If you're having these experiences, you've got to stage so-and-so. So throw the dice again and maybe you'll go up another ladder. But it's not about system, it's about story. And the people who have written about the discovery of God in intimacy, in mysticism, in contemplation, as well as in other ways, these are people who are not trying to tell you where to go next. They're telling you there is a next to go to. There is a growth to be undergone. As truly as in your human intimacies, so with God, there is a story to unfold. And so it is that somebody like St. John of the Cross can say, during this story, this process, expect to lose most of what you're taking for granted. Expect to lose sight of what now seems most vivid. And just as in your relationship with other human beings whom you love deeply, expect to be surprised. And if surprised, expect to be hurt. It's worrying, isn't it, going around saying, expect to be hurt? But I guess we would, if we had any sense at all, say it to anyone we knew embarking on some great new enterprise of love or service. Expect to be hurt. And perhaps we need to learn to say it more clearly and compassionately and imaginatively to people discovering faith in God. Expect to be hurt. Because God is not a cosmic teddy bear, any more than God is a cosmic formula or solution. And then again, you can come at it a slightly different way, turning to a slightly earlier writer, St. Bernard, in the early Middle Ages, talking in very bold terms about how you grow from one level of intimacy to another, and what he calls the kiss of the feet to the kiss of the mouth. A deepening directness, a deepening immediacy of experience with God, which ends up perhaps not with clarity and simple vision, but with an intimacy so deep that you can't actually see. When you're kissing somebody on the mouth, you haven't got a very good view of them, from one point of view. From another point of view, of course, you've got the best view possible. And again, a 20th century writer it was who said, sometimes you will be held so close to God's breast that you can't see his face. Expect to be hurt. Expect to be surprised. Expect intimacy to be unexpected. Because there is a story to be told. And so trying to draw these rambling remarks together a bit, I think what I'm saying is perhaps two or three main things. First of all, if it is true that encounter with God makes a difference to our lives, and I hope that's taken for granted in this company, then we are going to need images and metaphors which help us understand what kind of a difference that is. And for 2,000 years, Christians have reached for those images from human intimacy. And that is good and right. It's a reminder that what happens to us in encounter with God, in meeting with God, is no less serious, no less disturbing than the experiences that matter most to us in the rest of our human experience. Second main thing to pick out from this, once we've begun to use such images from human intimacy, we are, I think, much more deeply aware than we might have been before of what I've called the story nature of our relation with God. Not all at once, not all in a straight line, not all a clear advancing towards vision and enlightenment, but something much more like the painful surprises and the wonderful surprises of human intimacy. So that when somebody professes faith in God, we do need to be able to say to them, this is a journey of immense variety and danger and exhilaration. Richard Hooker, the great Anglican theologian of the 16th century, and at first blush one of the driest and most complex writers of the period, and a very unexpected person to bring into this discussion, Richard Hooker said in response to his Puritan critics, the trouble with you is you think faith is something that happens all at once. You've got it or you haven't. If you've got it, terrific, you know you're going to heaven, end of story. If you haven't got it, tough, you're going to hell. Why is it, says Hooker in response, that every other characteristic of human beings in their responses and their thinking and their exploring grows and changes and develops and flowers in experience, and faith doesn't? What is it about faith that makes it so inhuman, in your view? I think we may still need to hear words like that, because there are inhuman varieties of faith around. And then finally, back to what I was saying quite early on. If we don't have that sense of what intimacy with God is about, enacted for us, unfolded for us by those who make a life's work of the love of God. Woe betide us, really. Our sense of who we are as humans will fail and shrink. Our ordinary human loving will become less real. Our engagement with each other in art or politics will become less vivid. And so, intimacy with God, of the kind that some of these saints I've been talking about want us to reflect on, intimacy with God becomes not a kind of individual luxury for pious people. It becomes one of the deeply hidden but absolutely necessary springs of real humanity. And if we want to say in our religiously confused world something useful about religion and our culture, we should, I think, step back from any suggestion that religious talk simply solves intellectual problems, step back from any talk about how religion reinforces our morality. It may be true. Religious language does solve some problems. Religious belief does emphatically influence our morality. But most deeply, what is it about? It's about how much we want there to be of human beings. How much we want there to be of human beings. And to block up that particular well is to doom us to a very dry and a very dangerous future. So I end simply by asking how we are going to be able to speak in our society, in our culture, about intimacy with God in such a way that it will both suggest and make possible the kind of differences to our perception of human beings that I've been talking about. And I don't propose to give an answer to that, but to leave you with that as a challenge. Does our language and our behavior as religious people, as people of faith, as Christian people, does it look as though we believed that human beings were inexhaustible and amazing and surprising? Does it look as if we believed that human beings were an intelligible object for God to spend God's energies on? Does it look as if what we were talking about had to do with the very deepest secrets and hopes and terrors of the human heart? Does it look as if we knew what the human heart was like? Thank you.